This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Food, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amir Sayyad Abdi, the host of the channel. Today, I have the pleasure of talking to Professor Fabio Prosecoli about his book, Food, which was published in 2019 by the MIT Press, which is affiliated with Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Fabio is a professor in the Department of Nutrition and Food Studies, the New York University Steinhardt. Fabio, thanks for accepting my invitation and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
To start off, could you please tell us a bit about your personal and research background, Fabio?
Yes, so I didn't start as an academic for a few years. Well, after working in movies and other stuff, I wrote about international affairs, covering especially Muslim topics from Turkey all the way to the Philippines. And I did that for a few years. And then slowly I started writing about food, which has always been an interest of mine. And an Italian food and magazine, a food and wine magazine ended up asking me to move to New York and become their correspondent back in 98. And I worked for them for more than 10 years. And then when I was in New York, I started getting in touch with the academics working on food, especially at NYU, where I ended up teaching many years later. And I realized that I was very interested in that approach. So I decided to go back to school, got my doctorate, and you know, I started writing books and articles, started teaching. I worked at the New School where I launched the food studies program. And now I am at NYU in the nutrition and food studies department.
Thank you, Fabio. There is often a story behind every book, right? What's the story behind yours? How did this book come about?
Well, it was actually on the initiative of the MIT Press. They have this amazing series called Essential Knowledge. These are small books with a, you know, good content written by researchers, experts, academics, but for the general public. And they wanted to have something about food. So they got in touch with me. We started talking with the series editor. And, you know, it's difficult to do just, I mean, what do you start? Food, you know, they didn't know exactly what the angle could be, or what the focus could be. So I decided to make it sort of an introduction to food systems for the general public, you know, for consumers who wants to be more than consumers and maybe become citizens, understand more what are the stakes, what are the different players and what their role can be. And after I finished the book, you know, we were talking with the publisher about the title, and they decided to just go with food, because it's also part of a series where every book has got, you know, one topic. So it also fits there. And it's been a pleasure writing it, because I was really writing with the general public in mind. So I used all my academic research and experience, but I was using the style that I had developed as a food writer, as a journalist. And it was a great experience that I think is going to repeat itself also in the future.
It's a great experience reading it too, Fabio. One of the things you discuss early on in the book is the notion of eating local. What does eating local mean anyway in our increasingly globalized world? And what are some of the structures and dynamics around eating local? I mean, if we always buy the bread from the bakery in our neighborhood, or if we buy our meat from the local butchery, are we eating local?
Yes, exactly. That's one of the big issues in contemporary food system, that even experiences that we might perceive as local are actually global. As you mentioned, we go to the bakery next door and we get bread. Where does that wheat come from? Where do the ingredients come from? Where do the people working in the bakery come from? What sort of regulation allowed certain grains and not others to get to where you live, and so on and so forth? So I think the perception of the local is somehow contextual. Of course, you know, you can tell when produce that is grown is actually local when it comes from, you know, places that are near to you. But when it comes to manufactured products, that becomes a little more complicated. I mean, the coffee that you buy at the roaster down the street, it's local in the sense that you also create a local connection within a specific community, but the coffee ends up coming from very different places. So it's a little complicated, but what's interesting to me is that in the past couple of decades, there is sort of the idea that local is inherently better, also ethically inherently better, environmentally better. And it's a little more complicated than that. You know, what if you want to grow, I don't know, grapes in the desert of Nevada, because that's where you live, right? Yes, you would have local food, but how about the water that would be necessary? How about all the fertilizers and to make the land work for you? And also, local is not inherently more democratic in a way. It all depends on the governance of the local food system. Who has more power? Who are the players? How do they interact with each other? So in the book, I like to complicate a little bit this idea of eating local.
And another important aspect when it comes to food and food studies and food system is health and nutrition, which you assign a chapter to in your book. What would you say are the most pressing issues with regard to food and health?
Ooh, that's a very complicated and
general question. I know. Yes.
Yes. It's. I think, you know, it's also very much, let's say, contextual, because it depends on where you are, what sort of food you have access to, and what you can eat, what you can afford. So one of the problems that probably have become more urgent, it's growing inequalities between those who can afford certain things and those who can't, which has an immediate impact on health and nutrition, of course. And I think the COVID crisis has made these tensions even more visible, even heavier than they were before. Where I am, for instance, in the US, a problem is availability of accessible and affordable fresh food. It's much cheaper to buy mass-produced food or fast food in many cases. Also because the people working to produce those items are paid very little. And then, you know, they end up accessing food banks or other sorts of support. So in a way, the taxpayers end up subsidizing this industrial production. So in a way, I don't think that the issues of health and nutrition can be completely separated from the governance of the food system and environmental issues connected with it.
But my favorite chapter of the book is the one on environment and sustainability. Mm. And you introduce food waste as a sort of an entry point into your discussion on environment and sustainability. Why is that? Why is food waste, you know, so important when it comes to the issue of environment and sustainability in food systems?
Precisely, as you said, it's an entry point. It's something that I assume most readers would experience to a certain extent. You know, all of us has got a wilting piece of lettuce in the fridge or some cheese that has been molding. And I thought, and that's for the book in general, it's a good idea to start from experiences that the readers might be familiar with. So I started from there to then go into issues of, for instance, food loss along different supply chains in the food system in general. You know, lots of food gets lost on the fields or during transportation or because of bad warehousing. But these are aspects of the food loss in our system that readers might not directly be exposed to. So in a way to attract their attention in a way and take them to these more complicated aspects of the issues, I decided to go through the food waste that each of us is responsible for. Although, you know, in the large scheme of things, what consumers waste, yes, it is a lot, but it's never as much as what is lost before the food gets into their fridge.
And here's another general question, Fabio, but what's the role of technology in all this?
That's also something that I'm really passionate about because at least in the sort of food movement circles here in the US, very often you hear, I wouldn't say Luddite tones, but a sort of lack of trust in technology. Let's put it like that. And with good reasons. I mean, we know that technology can be responsible for many damages at the environmental level, at the social level, at the political level. But I do believe that technology has been crucial to the development of human food production since its beginning. Think about, I don't know, agricultural tools. Or, I don't know, think about a spoon or a knife. You know, those are technology, of course, different from the technologies we use today. But, you know, when new, plows were introduced in Europe in the 13th, 14th century, those were, you know, new technologies or new kind of mills. And now our new technology is mostly about the Internet of Things, blockchain, computer systems, the cloud, which is something that it's not tangible. And I think for that can be a little scarier, also because we hear so much about, you know, hacking and the damages of social media and whatnot. But at the same time, those tools could be used to improve the food system, even in terms of sustainability. I don't know. There might be systems to facilitate irrigations or to control the presence of pests or to communicate dangers with the weather and so on and so forth. I think what's really important is not so much the technology per se, but who owns the technology. We have a global system based on patents, which makes sense because it ensures income for inventors and creators and innovators. But at the same time, it excludes large segments of the human population from accessing this technology or from accessing the way they would need it or they would like it in a way. Sometimes even these good innovations are sort of imposed onto them, you know, from large companies. So I think that's something that we need to think about. You know, that one of the big technological issues these days is GMOs. There is a lot of pushback. You know, the scientists continue saying that there is no proof that GMOs are bad for humans, but at the same time, there is a lot of mistrust. Beyond this, we miss the whole issues of ownership of genetic material. Who owns it? Who makes money? What does it mean, for instance, for agrobiodiversity? What does it mean for, you know, for the environment? So once again, you know, we go to the governance, political aspects of the food system, even when we're talking about technology.
And while we are on the subject of, you know, having access to certain resources, I want to talk about a bit about food insecurity, which is oftentimes looked at as an economic issue or a social issue. But as you argue in the book, it is also deeply political, right?
Yes, because the way the food system is structured depends on political decisions. You know, what regulations are implemented, what laws are in the book, what people can do or cannot do. And in many political systems, that depends on the clout that certain groups can have, for instance, on lawmakers. Here in the US, we have a very well-oiled lobbying system. So food industries have access to lawmakers and they invest in them. They donate for their campaigns and the lobbyists know how to push certain agendas. And I think that's very important because when we look at the problems in the food system, very often, you know, we take the position that we can make changes by voting with our wallet. Basically, if we don't like a product, if we don't like how a company acts, we can decide not to buy that product and that company will have to change either the product or their behavior, which is true in many cases, but those changes do not go to the structural issues underlying phenomenon that we see in the food system, the distribution, access, safety networks. So very often we look at what we can do as individuals, as consumers in a way, but we forget that we're also citizens, citizens that can vote, citizens that can take part in all sorts of local, regional, national, even international initiatives, people that can get organized and create other kinds of lobbying to pressure lawmakers and so on. So for me, this putting together our identity as consumers and as citizens is really fundamental if we hope to make any changes in the food systems. And I think, you know, COVID has really showed us, not that it doesn't work, because it's working precisely the way it was designed for, which is for efficiency, quantity, and profit, but it doesn't work for everybody. And even the people for whom it normally works have seen that there are issues, there are weak nodes. You know, we all have been looking for flour that didn't arrive to stores. Here in the US, the meat industry was hit because many workers were sick. The farming industry was also hit because of the same reasons. And also, suddenly it was more difficult for migrants to come into the country. So these are large structural issues that cannot be solved or even addressed by the single consumers. They need to be tackled by community, by citizens that get together.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So most books on food nowadays, or at least the ones that I have come across, have a final chapter that deals in some ways with the future of food. And your book is not an exception in this regard, Fabio. The title of your concluding chapter is actually "What Happens Next?" And that is exactly my question. What happens next, Fabio?
Yeah, keep in mind that I wrote this book before COVID.
Yes, yes.
Lots of things has changed, but overall, I think, I don't know, now looking at where we are, what comes next, I think it's the need to look at the excessive efficiency of the system in a way, you know, the fact that it's all organized in just in time, you know, to reduce costs, to increase profits. But when even one of those links doesn't work, and with any kind of shock like COVID or weather or God knows what, you know, this lean character, this hyper-efficient character of many supply chains doesn't work. So probably we have to go back and add some redundancy to our systems. Maybe it might not be the most efficient way to butcher animals to go back to smaller slaughterhouses, but it would guarantee a better distribution of meat in case, you know, the large plants run into problems. And also, I think the fact that COVID is creating huge supply chain issues has made people more aware of the extent of globalization. Maybe not so much for the ingredients, but for the whole supply chains, for machinery, for oil, for transportation. There are so many, let's say, non-food aspects in the food system that have been impacted by the pandemic and what's happening these days, that people that before didn't even think about those issues suddenly are forced to. And I think one of the aspects of the future probably will be this wider awareness of issues in the food systems than that before, you know, were not so visible. Hopefully it's, you know, it won't be dramatic and it won't be because of new shocks. But if there is one moment where changes can be made, this could be it, in a way. And it's something that we have to keep in mind. And it's not just about COVID. As I said, it's about climate change, for instance. You know, we have more and more very destructive weather events. Agriculture has a huge impact on climate change. We'll see what happens. That, you know, the younger generation probably is much more aware than we were about these issues.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think that will bring changes in the future. But at the same time, you know, they're also the ones that keep on buying, you know, cell phones and using Bitcoins, for which, you know, lots of energy needs to be used to run servers and whatnot. So we'll see what happens there.
Yeah. Hopefully something good.
Hopefully something good.
Yes, there's obviously a lot more in the book, and I encourage listeners to pick up a copy. But before we wrap up the interview, I'd like to ask whether you're working on something right now, Fabio, or are you thinking about doing research on a particular topic in the near future?
Yes, I'm working on two projects right now. Actually, let's make it three. The next one, really almost done, we're working on the proof, is a book that is going to be about food identity and politics. And in particularly, I'll be looking at how food is used as an ideological tool in contemporary politics. I'm looking at, you know, the different populist movements, but also, you know, food sovereignty movements, what it means when food gets entangled in this sort of large political issues. And I'm looking at it really from a global point of view, because I do believe that the food system is becoming more and more global. And so what happens in the US cannot be completely separated from what happens in China or in India or in Brazil. So that's the project that it's almost done. It's also a book for the general public. So once again, I have used all my research, but I've tried to write and to organize the material in a way that it's very accessible to anybody who's interested in the topic, not necessarily other academics. You know, we tend to write for other academics, especially when, you know, we're working up the sort of the we're trying to do our career, right? I'm lucky enough to be a full professor, which allows me more independence. And I think, you know, I can embrace more, I think, the duty that we have as scholars, as researchers, as academics, to distribute our knowledge and make it relevant for the communities where we are. So I'm really enjoying writing in this style. My second project is based on a three-year grant that was given to me by the Poland Science Center, which is the National Research Center for Poland. And it's going to be on the reevaluation of local traditional foods in Poland. So I've been going there quite often to do ethnographic work mostly, and to meet people and to interview people, to spend time there, getting to understand the place, trying to learn the language, which it's not easy. And to this day, my Polish, it's quite ridiculous, but I've now I can follow a conversation, I can ask questions, and it makes work much easier. And the third topic I'm work on, it's food and design. So how design can contribute to improve our relationship with food and to improve the food system. So already in 2019, I collaborated with the Victoria and Albert Museum in London for an exhibition called Food Bigger Than a Plate. And we're trying to bring the exhibition here in New York. It's not official yet, so I cannot say more than this, but I'll be consulting curator for that exhibition. I'm working also on an exhibition on food and fashion here in New York, actually fashion and food. And in Italy, I'm working on an exhibition on Italians and food. And I'm in charge of one section of the exhibition that is precisely about the future. And so design technology are front and center there. And I'm going to write a couple of essays on the topic for the catalog of the exhibition.
So you've been busy, Fabio. Those are too many projects, but they are all equally interesting and exciting. And I can't wait to read them or in terms of that exhibition to see it whenever they come out. Do you have any further comments? Anything you want to add, Fabio?
Again, out of this conversation, I think it's what I would like that it comes out is how important it is to communicate in an accessible way, even as scholars. I don't think that using obscure language is always necessary. Sometimes it is because you're dealing with issues and topics and theories and methods that require precision and rigor. But we have to remember that we're also part of, larger communities, and learning how to speak different languages, which can be an article or on a magazine or an exhibition or a book for the general public, I think it's really important. And I think this is going to be the direction of my work, whatever the topics will be, but it's going to be the direction of my work in the next few years.
Yes. Thank you, Fabio, for writing such a book and for writing it so accessibly. I really enjoyed reading it. And thank you so much for coming on the show and speaking with me today and sharing your insight and your fantastic work with our listeners. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
You too.